Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome back. I'm Carmack and this is Combat Chronicles. And thanks to a fairly prominent combat sports media member today, I might have some new listeners. So for those that are regulars, apologies for the spiel. For those that are new, talk about everything here. Boxing, MMA, kickboxing, Muay Thai as well. But today's episode is all about boxing because this is the week of boxing. For those that aren't subscribed to the Combat Chronicles Patreon, www.patreon.com/combatchronicles, you'll not be aware how accurate my prediction for Naoya Inoue versus Stephen Fulton really was.
That was a textbook. He jabbed down in the stomach. We said this earlier. He jabbed down the stomach to try and come over the top with that right hand. He's throwing it multiple times in this fight. 2 minutes left in the round. Can Inoue get the stoppage here in round eight and become a four division world champion? He is pouring it on. Fulton doing his best to fight back. The referee steps in and it is over. Naoya Inoue is now the unified junior featherweight champion of the world.
Excuse me, man, that's super bantamweight to you. Eighth round stoppage for Naoya Inoue. It looked like he was about to emphatically spark Stephen Fulton out when the referee jumped in, but did catch him with a mean left hook as he dropped him. Let's just talk about how I saw the fight going into it. Over on the Patreon, did the preview podcast this past Sunday. So I give everyone a couple of days to consume it and also just get excited for the fight, which I like to do, get everyone pumped up and, you know, get excited for the bout. But I did have my reservations about the fight. I had my reservations about Stephen Fulton. I was a little bit, I was not a fence sitter in terms of how I saw the fight. And I'll tell you where I went right and where I went wrong was basically the round prediction. I thought two or three rounds. It was wrapped up within two or three rounds, essentially. Was wrong about the round prediction. That's not really what analysis is, though, based on the you don't really base it on whether I get it right. You know, if you pick a knockout, a decision, okay, that's something. But in terms of actually jotting down the X's and O's of how the bout will play out, that's what's important. You know, the actual result, it's not that great. I mean, you could get it perfect, but it could be a robbery decision. No one's going to say your analysis was wrong. But we'll get to that in a minute anyway, in terms of how the X's and O's and the ebb and flow played out in the bout. But I was not that excited for this as a contest. Based on my own opinions of Stephen Fulton, the tape study, etc., did not see this elite level operator people were talking about. I was seeing people picking him to win by decision. I mean, I guess if he was going to win it, that was how. I did actually mark out paths to victory for him, but they all came with caveats. The best route for Stephen Fulton would have been to rough up Inoue on the inside. We'll look at that in a second, because that didn't even work. But the big problem was actually filling that space and getting to Inoue. And I didn't really, based on the footage I've seen of Fulton and in the fights, which I detailed in that Patreon podcast, see a sustainable route to get in there without taking some heavy artillery back. Fulton covers distance with long steps behind wide punches. Not great against a shorter, sharper, faster, accurate counterpuncher like Inoue. And he doesn't punch. So the way to beat Inoue is similar, even though not that's similar in terms of their styles, and I hate to use this comparison because new listeners are going to go, oh, he's picked him because he's he's Asian. But that's not the case. But much like how Juan Manuel Marquez dealt with Manny Pacquiao, you've got to be able to punch with him. You've got to be able to have continued success in exchanges. If you just cover up and shell up and wait to go, then he's going to beat you when he's leading, and he's going to beat you on the counter as well. You've got to be able to hold it in there with him. Now, you're going to say, well, that's easier said than done. Yes, it is. That's why it will take a special caliber of fighter to beat Naoya Inoue, much as it took special fighters to beat Manny Pacquiao in his prime. Eric Morales, Juan Manuel Marquez, and, of course, Floyd Mayweather. I'm not counting Tim Bradley, even though Bradley done some good things and didn't actually win that fight. But you see what I mean. It takes special fighters to beat special fighters. And I did not see that with Stephen Fulton. I did not think he was a special fighter. I did not consider him an elite level caliber fighter. And it's played out like that in the fight. People will say, but he had two bouts. As I said on that other podcast, I broke down why it was somewhat of a hollow achievement. The current dearth of talent in the super bantamweight division. The fact that one of them bouts was ostensibly vacant, even though it wasn't, but it had been very, very recently. The caliber of opposition that Fulton beat to win those two bouts, and the skills he had displayed in those two bouts. He's not bad. He's not bad. But he was not on Inoue's level. My stylistic breakdown of how they matched up with each other was that Inoue would be able to jab with Fulton, that Inoue would have no issues landing a cross counter with Fulton, and that he'd probably use that right hand to then move Fulton into his left hand. And essentially, Inoue did end up doing anything he wanted in this bout. He was able to jab with him, being the shorter guy, utilise an up jab. He constantly used the straight body jab as well, which caused havoc for Fulton throughout the fight. He was then bringing punches behind that. There's one sequence, can't remember what round it was in, but just to break it down. Inoue baited the right hand with the body jab, so drew out Fulton's own lead right, and then hooked off the jab, level change. So he's jabbed to the body, drew out the right hand, and then gone with the hook off the jab upstairs over the right hand that's coming in. This is the thing about Inoue that I spoke about in the preview. He's very good at using his foot speed and hand speed to get you into situations that you're unable to respond to in a quick amount of time. So Inoue, he knew that even with that right hand coming towards him, he'd be able to get the hook over the top. And lo and behold, if you find that sequence, you will see exactly how it worked. Didn't come off perfectly, because I think Inoue would have liked to drop Fulton with that shot, but it did clip him on the top of the head. It just shows what he's able to do with his pure athleticism, his timing, his boxing nails, his boxing brain, etc, etc. Fulton was trying to box Inoue early and get him to follow him around the ring, and just try and outbox him essentially with a pure sort of boxer stance. Just circumnavigating him, lateral movement. Problem is, Inoue was moving around with his own jab. Fulton was not quick enough, not authoritative enough a puncher. Didn't have the timing. Basically was not able to win the battle with the jabs. So even though I picked a knockout 2-3 rounds, that didn't happen. Definitely by the end of 2-3 rounds, it was over. Fulton did have moments in the fifth and had a particularly good seventh. But at that point, Inoue just seemed to be amping it up, walking him down and throwing more punches and bunches, and just trying a variety of different things to try and open Fulton up. But the thing is with Inoue, he's not, if we use a MMA comparison for this, let's use Chito Vera. Chito Vera needs big moments to win rounds, okay? When he's not doing that, he doesn't fill the space enough with scoring work that allows him to be a consistent round winner. Okay, what Inoue does with his jab to fill that space is when he's not landing the big shots, and he lands them regularly because his timing is how explosive, and his hand speed and foot speed to close the distance is, he is always doing that. But when he's not having that success, whipping the right hand around the guard or coming underneath the uppercut or just barreling into someone with a big, wide, fast left hook, he's landing jabs consistently. He's landing jabs to the body. He would bait out Fulton's own jab with a low left hand to bait out the jab so he could then counter it with his own as he was coming in. He was utilising a check hook and pivoting out as he threw it. He was walking into Fulton with the left hook, the check left hook. Usually a check left hook, you would assume they're coming towards you. You move your weight onto your own back leg and drag the left hook over. Anyway, he was doing that as he was stepping forward and using that to pivot out around the side. leading Fulton in, popping off, spinning out, regaining centre ring. Just a master, really. And that body jab, consistently, what was great about it? He's using punches upstairs to divert Fulton's attention from the hooks coming down to the body or the uppercuts coming from underneath. And he's using that body jab to bring Fulton's hands down steadily. So as the finishing sequence happens, it's the jab leading to the right hand upstairs that gets it going. The fighter I've used as a comparison for Inoue in the past has always been Wilfredo Gomez. Not a perfect stylistic comparison, but in terms of how they approach the fight. Economic, punches and bunches limited to twos and threes. You know, relying on accuracy and timing rather than shoe shining. Breaking the opponent down and being a really efficient finisher. And the economic movement. So if you look at them both, you'll see comparisons. They're not exact stylistic comparison. It's not like watching, say, Muhammad Ali and Tyrell Biggs, where you can see the influence. But in terms of how they approach the fight, their attributes, and how they deploy those attributes across the course of a fight to get to a certain point, i.e. with setups, breaking opponents down, utilising tactics that will pay dividends later on in the fight, using throwaways to gather reads, all these things, in a way, Wilfredo Gomez, I think, are quite similar fighters. And if you look at the records, obviously Wilfredo Gomez's KO record was absolutely mind-blowing, and based on his odd 30-odd fights before he fought Salvador Sanchez, his record is definitely more impressive than Inoue's in terms of competition faced and beaten. But the reputation that Wilfredo Bazooka Gomez had in his prime is very similar to the reputation that now Inoue is garnering now. And what's great is that more people are buying in now Inoue's fought an American opponent. Because there's always the idea, it's not like he hasn't fought people from all over the place, but there's been a bit hype behind this fight due to things that have taken place in the last week. That's got people thinking, now this guy's got a real challenge. He's moving up in weight to fight an undefeated American. Yeah, a guy with two belts. This is going to be the test. And Inoue's just blasted through Fulton. And what was really interesting is when they did have those collisions that brought them close together, i.e. when Inoue stepped into the check hook, it didn't quite work, and they got into a tangle. Actually, Inoue was pretty strong. Was able to push Fulton off pretty quickly. One of the X factors for me was if Fulton could get on close, would he be able to use an overhook to wrestle Inoue around, take one of his weapons away and start chipping away on the inside? That is how he's going to win. Work his way into the on the inside, chip away at Inoue, and later on in the fight, tire him out by being the bigger man and having sustained a consistent amount of work throughout the fight. And Inoue actually shut him down on the inside as well. So Fulton, at least a level below. I'm vindicated in that regard. The sort of technical ebb and flow that I predicted and how Fulton would not be able to gain a foothold in the fight is somewhat correct. This is not a podcast where I have a victory lap, though, because, quite frankly, for long-time listeners, they'll know that a lot of this podcast is me explaining where I went wrong, why things weren't picked up, why things went differently to how we anticipated. In this one, it worked out pretty nicely, and I'm happy because there's a lot of people picking Fulton that were picking him for reasons that I didn't quite understand. Saying, oh yeah, he's a really good pure boxer. Well, is he? Is he a really good pure boxer? What, because he jabs and moves a bit? Good pure boxers can jab on the move whilst remaining defensively responsible. Good boxers that jab on the move don't typically get jabbed with to the extent that Fulton does. Good pure boxers don't really be that open to a right hand counter over the jab. Don't really get corralled into corners as much as Fulton did. What he's trying to do is not necessarily what he was good at. I thought his best performance was against Figueroa when he was good on the inside. That's what he showed. But again, that was a fighter who was willing to engage him on the inside. A fighter who walked him down. Who gave him a chance to show off that that offensive skill and somewhat defensive skill on the inside. And funnily enough, one of the things I said was I could see if Inoue did corner him, that once he got a flurry going, Fulton's hands tend to drop. And that's actually how that final finishing sequence played out. Anyway, throwing in volume, Fulton comes down, he comes over his lead leg, and suddenly his head is protruding, he's not protecting himself. Now, it was a foregone conclusion at that point, but it's kind of what I was envisioning if that sort of thing would happen. I don't think people thought that anyway was going to beat Fulton on the inside, and I didn't, and he didn't. He just was able to hang there. No one's going to say, anyway, beat him on the inside. It's not Pernell Whitaker and Hudo Cesar Chavez. I'm saying that when Fulton is backed up to the ropes in that position, he's not that good defensively. He's not moving practically. He's not bending at the knees. These are all things that he doesn't do under duress. That was the point. This idea that he's an all-terrain fighter is something I disagreed with. I'm sorry for him, it didn't work out. Seems a nice guy. But overall, it's kind of good to see those things get exposed. It might make people think about the way they analyse fights. And what's also of particular interest to this actual fight is that the controversy about the hand wraps we saw prior to the bout. For those that are unaware, Fulton's trainer said that he was not happy about Inoue's hands were being wrapped. There was evidence prior to the, I think, first or second on-air fight. I should know this, but I think it was the first on-air fight where Inoue's hands weren't wrapped according to US guidelines. It's permitted in Japan, but actually Nonito Donaire's team were the team that were those that had actually requested that particular type of hand wrapping to be allowed with the extra layer. In this fight, Fulton's team watched Inoue like a hawk while his hands were being wrapped. They filmed it, they signed off on it, and Inoue still battered Fulton and stopped him. So for us boxing fans, it's nice to know that regardless what he tried to do to now Inoue to throw him off his game, regardless whether you think he's got stacked hand wraps or not, he will just take you out anyway. What next for Naoyu Inoue then? He's conquered every division he's fought in. He's been absolutely fantastic. He hasn't conquered every division he's fought in. I'm still not content with his reign at super flyweight, in which he missed the best fighters around. Even though I once ranked him as the 10th greatest super flyweight, don't anymore. He was definitely surpassed by those that followed in his wake. Greater fighters, pound for pound, arguably. Not today. I think anyway, after this, has proven himself one of the top three best pound for pound fighters in the world. There's another guy or guys that are looking to leapfrog him this coming weekend. More on that in the next section of the podcast. But what next for him? Well, he's going to fight Marlon Tapales next, who's the Filipino champion who holds the other two bouts, the WBA and IBF. I'm a bit annoyed about that because even though Marlon deserved to win the fight with Mirjon Akhmadaliev, if Akhmadaliev had pulled his hand out of his ass and won that fight, I think we'd be talking about a much more interesting fight. He was a top amateur. He was undefeated. He is from Uzbekistan. He's under 30 years old. He hasn't got that. Well, he has now because he's lost. But at the point, at the time, he was looking like, oh, this is a bit of a riddle for the division. He's a different kind of style to what Inoue is for. He's a really sort of dynamic southpaw. Would have been really interesting to see that fight. Maybe it will still happen. I think Inoue unifies the bouts by the end of the year, wins all four bouts, fucks off the featherweight, and fights, hopefully, in-house for the WBO featherweight title against Herbici Ramirez. Now, I did a podcast the other week on Andy Cruz. I considered the lineage of great Cuban amateurs over the last 20 years to be Yuriocus Gamboa, Hilama Regendal, Robicio Ramirez, and now Andy Cruz. And Robicio Ramirez, for me, is might have been the best of the bunch at the time, but he's had a weird run. He's had a really, really weird run. He went from being two-time Olympic gold medalist, and at that point, I think he was probably as respected amateur as ever been. He was about as respected, I think, as Lomachenko was turning pro. Towards the end of his amateur career, seemed to be phoning it in. Lost a couple of fights in the World Series of Boxing. Once to Zoyarov, the Uzbek, another Uzbek fighter, who actually, you know, excellent fighter in his own regard, Olympic gold medalist. But I think, essentially, I think at that point, Ramirez had shut down. He had one eye on the pros. He did not want to be fighting for Cuba anymore for nothing. And I think that he was looking to find a way out. And I think he was getting by on pure talent. Now, I actually classed the World Series of Boxing, which are, you know, amateur bouts fought under pro rules for money as pro bouts. So he should have three pro losses. And you say three? He only lost two in the World Series. Yes, because getting by on pure talent, he fought Adam Gonzalez in his first pro bout, got dropped early, looked absolutely appalling against a fairly one-route opponent. And fair play to Gonzalez because he really fucking turned up. He did not turn up as the opposition. He turned up the win. And he won well. And I think that was Ramirez finally learning, hey, this ain't the amateurs anymore. You can't fuck around. And you can't fuck around in the pros either because this is real. You can't get by on pure talent anymore. When you have a somewhat unmotivated Cuban expat, you send him to the other Cuban expat, Ismael Salas, quality trainer, who shored up Ramirez's defensive problems, got him back to somewhat of his form as an amateur. He later avenged that loss to Gonzalez. He's now 12-1 as a pro, although you could say he's like, what, 24-3 based on the World Series of Boxing bouts as well. And now he's won the WBO vacant title against Isaac Dogby in his last fight. Looked really good in that. And he just smashed Satoshi Shimizu, who's an Olympic bronze medalist. Never really a big fan of his. Weird, lanky guy. Not one of these guys sort of stays on the outside. He's just a weird, lanky guy. And smashed in the bits. And he just looks fantastic. He's with Top Rank. Always the example I use, and it was at featherweight as well. Just spoke about Uriorkis Gamboa. Bob Arum, he famously let the Juan Manuel Lopez, who was coming up from super bantamweight, super fight, and it was a super fight at the time. If you think that Inoue and Fulton's big, you do not believe how hyped everyone was for Uriorkis Gamboa versus Juan Manuel Lopez. It was huge. It was massive. It was massive. It wasn't Pacquiao Mayweather, but it was fucking huge. Way bigger in terms of excitement. It was probably about as... People were about as excited for that as they were for Arthur Bud Crawford and Errol Spence. And yeah, more on that again in a couple of minutes. But Bob Arum let that marinate too long. It fell apart. Juan Manuel Lopez had a particularly bad fight against Rogers Mataguá, who was a sort of unheralded gatekeeper type. Batted him around the ring. Gamboa later splintered Mataguá pretty easy. And then he lost to Salido, who Gamboa had already beat. So the fight fell apart. Bob Arum's fault. Shouldn't let it wait that long. He was just trying to get as many paydays as possible out of two lads. Terrible, really. I hope he won't do it with Ramirez and Inoue, because Inoue would be ready to move up to featherweight. It's a great fight of the best amateur of his generation prior to leaving, because Andy Cruz has obviously taken that mantle now. And one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world. And arguably the best pound-for-pound fighter below featherweight. So everything under where Ramirez has fought as a pro, Inoue is the man. I think you could definitely make a case that for the last era. I'm talking best pound-for-pound fighter of the last era, not the best pound-for-pound fighter ever under featherweight. God, I would not be saying that, that's for sure. And I think you can make a case for Roman Gonzalez or Juan Francisco Estrada to be that. But Inoue's got a case. He's certainly the best pound-for-pound fighter right now under featherweight. And if he clears up the bantamweight, he would have been unified at two weight classes and held titles at light flyweight and flyweight. So 108, 115, super flyweight, did not fight at flyweight, 118 unified, 122 unified, and we'd be fighting Ramirez, who I imagine would have another defence by then, so had a couple defences at featherweight, two-time gold medalist, one of the best amateurs of all time, and he's just fought on Japanese TV, which bodes well. The Japanese will get to know him, they should put him on another defence, maybe against another Japanese fighter on Inoue's next fight. That's what they should do. Build him up. You know, it's not a mega fight for everyone, because I think some people will look at his record and go, lost in his debut. But for those that know, for those that got a memory longer than 10 minutes, can you imagine a couple of years ago someone said, Rabisi Ramirez is going to turn pro and he's going to fight Naoya Inoue for the world title. You'd have just fucking spunk like Randy from South Park there and then, like that famous gif. You'd have lost your fucking shit. It could happen. And Ramirez looks back on form against Shimizu today. It looked fantastic. It's just these over exaggerated feints and level changes and always setting you up, whipping shots over the top. He's got the defensive responsibility to be able to deal with Inoue. He's be able to punch with Inoue because he's so poised in the pocket. He'll be able to back Inoue up because he's constantly feinting, offering him either hand, mixing up the head and body. He can bombard over the top or from underneath, as he saw today. Mix up the head and body. He's slick. He's quick. It's a great matchup. And I think if Inoue is going to move up to featherweight. Let's fucking make it. Bob, you know, Romero's never going to be a massive attraction, so you might as well put his belt on the line. If he beats Inoue, he can become a bigger attraction. And if not, Inoue fights a guy that people have somewhat heard of, but if nothing else, it'll make for a wonderful fight in a technical perspective. It would be wonderful to watch. I think he'll beat Topalis pretty easily, and that's on the agenda. If not, fucking hell, let's bring Inoue over to the UK to fight Lee Wood. My God, be amazing. There's a guy that would punch with him. Wood might get splattered, but we know with Wood, before you can kill him, he's like a zombie. He'll keep coming back. The 2022 Combat Chronicles Fight of the Year, Lee Wood versus Michael Conlan, just shows how resilient he is. He's a strong featherweight. I'd love to see that as well. So from now in a ways future, the end of 2023 and beyond, to the immediate future, because if I didn't think that Inoue versus Fulton was a legitimate super fight, the one coming up this weekend definitely is. Errol Spence versus Terence Bud Crawford. Crawford champion at lightweight, unified champion at light welterweight. Now, at welterweight, he's got a belt as well, but the other three belts are held by Errol Spence. So, a proper super fight in one of boxing's marquee divisions. None of that junior super bastard shit. And for a proper super fight, you need a proper super guest. After this. Right, so we're talking about all things Terence Crawford versus Errol Spence. And for the discussion, I had to get a heavy hitter on, so I've got the main man himself, managing director of Boxing News, Rob Tebbutt. Rob, how's it going, mate?
Carl, always a pleasure, mate. Thanks very much for having me. I'm doing well. As I mentioned to you before, I'm a little bit tired, but the game is the game. How are you, my friend? Always good to catch up.
Yeah, I'm all right, mate. I think, you know, it's going to be a tiring week of content creation. Got two big, huge fights coming up. Big, huge, you know, I'm asleep myself, as you can tell, using every word in the dictionary. But we've got Inoue versus Fulton, which I'm going to cover separately. I'm hyped for it, but I don't know about you, Rob, but for me, it doesn't feel quite as super fighty as Errol Spence and Terence Crawford. So that's the one we're going to focus on, mate. And first and foremost, before we get into the nuts and bolts of it, you got any sort of sweeping predictions for the fight? Do you know who you think's going to win?
For Spence Crawford? It's a 50-50 fight, but it seems like everybody is picking Terence Crawford from my perspective. Over the years, I have leaned towards the natural size and the activity of Spence in a very close fight. But, and I don't want to sit on the fence, so I will make a prediction. But the last couple of years, I think any fan who's been plugged into what Errol Spence has been doing and the inactivity, the eye injuries, the car crashes, and in the same time, seeing where Terence Crawford is, Crawford seems to be in a wonderful place. He seems to be in a very cold, detached, confident place. And that's a very difficult man to bet against. But I have always leaned towards Spence's activity, his fundamentals. But Crawford does have that X factor. He does have the natural freakish athleticism. And that is something that, the closer the fight has come, I have been swaying more towards Crawford. But because this has been one of those fights that's 5, 6, 7, however many years in the making, I suppose, or certainly 5 years in the making, I kind of feel like I've come too far to change my pick now. So I'm still kind of, through loyalty, if nothing else, on the Errol Spence side of things. But it is a 50-50 fight, and anybody who tells me that Terence Crawford's going to win, I don't really have any argument. I don't really have any counter argument to it. But through, I guess, sheer pig-headed ignorance and stubbornness, I'm still going for Errol Spence. But it's a pick that I've become less and less confident in, put it that way.
Well, you're talking to me, mate. I love pig-headedness and stubbornness. So, you know, that's very much my thing too. Funnily enough, we'll talk about, say, some of the technical aspects in a minute, but the more tape study I've done leading into it, and definitely of recent fights, like you just alluded to, I have become more certain that I'm going to be picking Terence Crawford in this fight. And I think it's just a craft thing, like you say, like that natural athleticism, but it gives him that ability to make those reads and those split-second decisions. And it's his setups, his way, he's always looking ahead, always
drawing you into something you're not sure about. I just think he's got an added edge in craft. Now, we'll talk about Errol Spencer's craft in a second because he's not some lumbering oaf, as we all know. But I just think there's a little thing. You mentioned X Factor. I just think there's a little extra edge there for Crawford in terms of his ability to do things that other people can't. And I think that might be the difference. I think I don't see a stoppage. I'm going to make a prediction myself. I predict that we're going to have an absolute nightmare on social media come Sunday morning, because I think you've got very clearly defined camps of fans. There are, of course, the people like us that are just looking for a good fight and are appreciative of both boxes. But I think the shit slinging you're going to see after what is a competitive fight between two elite fighters, it's just going to be a nightmare to sift through, basically. So we often get it. You know, we had it after, for a recent example, Lomachenko and Haney. Good competitive fight that became basically World War III in the immediate aftermath. And for this one, I think it might be even worse, mate, to be honest with you. So my next question is, based on their fights against fighters of a similar ilk, and I don't think there's much examples here, how do you think either man is going to approach the bout?
Yeah, I think you mentioned there about kind of, I mean, it's just going to take kind of a detour way to answer the question, I suppose, take the scenic route. But yeah, when you kind of consider that they have boxed the same fighters, which is the very different stages of their careers, I feel. Kell Brook and Amir Khan being two obvious examples. Porter, sort of. I think the Porter that fought Spence wasn't massively dissimilar to the Porter that boxed Crawford. I don't think you can necessarily say the same thing about Errol Spence, not Amir Khan. Obviously, Spence didn't box. Not Errol Spence. Kell Brook, not Amir Khan, because Spence didn't box.
Rob, just for anyone listening, mate, it's 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, mate. So, you know.
Yeah, and I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning last night working, which is why I have these beautiful bags under the eyes. But anyway, they do have some mutual opponents, but they've boxed them at different stages of their career. And they are very different fighters. And the old adage of styles make fights, you know as well as I do, as corny as it sounds sometimes, it is very much true. I think it's fair to say, regardless, I think, you know, a lot of talk is about Errol Spence's resume and comparing it to Crawford's. I am one of the people who, I guess, looks at Crawford's resume and still struggles to find that career-defining win. But having said that, I don't think you can look at Errol Spence's resume and, you know, it isn't a murderer's row. He does have a better resume, but this is the fight that they both need. I think Spence, you mentioned it earlier, he is somewhat underrated as a technician, yes, because he's fundamentally, you know, quite solid, but tactically he's pretty good in some instances. But he's against somebody here where it's going to be put to the test. It is that X factor. It is, I think a lot of talk is about Crawford not facing somebody on Spence's level, and obviously the same is true for Spence. He's never boxed somebody in Crawford who is still prime, unbeaten, can switch, has all the athleticism and the ring IQ and the smarts that you were talking about, and can set those traps. And I watched Kell Brook and Sean Porter talk about Spence in the ring and said that he wasn't the most naturally intelligent guy, and Porter was able to maneuver him in some instances. And, you know, Porter's not somebody who we're really kind of, you know, we think of when it comes to, you know, a smart fighter and somebody who's going to be able to kind of position you in the ring and move you around and what have you. So the fact that Porter's able to say that, I don't think that fills Spence backers or shouldn't fill Spence backers with a lot of confidence. As far as how the fight goes, I mean, we know how Crawford tends to approach fights early on. He tends to take his time. He tends to have a couple of rounds to have a look and just start edging the feet into position and feinting and just looking for the gaps. And as you said earlier, thinking ahead and just seeing what sort of looks that he can give and the reactions that those looks get. Spence, on the other hand, is busy. He's busy from the opening bell to the final bell. He becomes more attritional as the fight comes on. But those early rounds, I do feel like Spence will get off to a good start. I do think Spence will win a couple of the earlier rounds. And then as Crawford starts to pick up the pace, I think the real fight will start around 3 and 4. But Spence is, you know, he's a big, fundamentally solid southpaw, throws loads of punches. Those guys are not easy to deal with. You look at Paul Williams and fighters of that ilk who are busy and can just occupy you. And Spence, I think, is better than people think with regards to layering his shots, touching, whip, bang. And I think in the past, we've seen him kind of build up that head of steam. And in those middle rounds, that's when he starts to motor. The issue that he's got in this fight is he's against somebody who's going to expect that and is going to have a plan for it and is able to switch his game plan on the fly. And that's, as we know, kind of what separates a good fighter from a great fighter and a world-class fighter is the ability to adapt and change the path of the fight on the fly. I don't think Crawford will... Don't get me wrong, I don't think he's going to be giving up the early rounds, but I don't think he'll mind if he's able to get the kind of reactions and he's able to get the kind of the scouting report that he's looking for in those early rounds to then pick up the pace as the fight goes. Usually for Spence, I always look at Spence in the second half of the fight and feel like that's going to be kind of where he comes into his own and he separates himself from his opposition. But in this instance, I kind of feel the longer the fight goes, that I expect in 7, 8, 9, Crawford to have been warmed into the fight and then to start letting his big shots go, like from but probably slightly earlier than that. But I think 7, 8, 9 is where we're going to see the best of Crawford. And then it's just as we get into 10 and then the championship rounds, what does he have left and can Spence go? And if he can go, can Crawford go with him? And I think the answer to both of those questions is yes. I think Spence will go as the fight goes on and the fight goes late and he'll try and finish strong. And Crawford, the competitive nature of him, and you know, he's stopped Sean Porter late in the fight. I think he will go with him. So I'm expecting Spence to get off to a lead and I expect him to try and get behind the jab early. I expect him to try and stifle Crawford, keep his distance, maybe try and make it a bit of a boring fight. I think it will be fairly tentative early on, but I don't think Crawford will necessarily mind that if he gets what he wants and he can start picking up the pace in those middle rounds.
I think what you just mapped out there in terms of ebb and flow as well, we're looking forward to it. Because if that is probably the way it's going to go, and I think that that's why people are excited for this. Because as you mentioned, resume-wise, Crawford's been fighting at a higher level for longer and has fought more guys that generally we've heard of. Errol Spence, due to the layoff, due to the out-of-ring issues we've both mentioned, he's only really been fighting top-level opposition for, you know, what, since Cal Brook, really. That was a step up at the time. He's fought a couple of guys we've heard of before that, Chris Van Heerden and a couple of others, you know, people that we've heard of. But really, he's really been fighting top-level opposition since the Cal Brook fight. And it's been sporadic. I think it's something like 7 fights in 6 years. One of them was...
I think he's Panther. 5 title defences in 6 years. I think he's now the second longest reigning welterweight champion, but with the fewest defences out of anybody in the top five.
That's quite the stat.
Yeah.
And some of them were against, you know, fighters that were, I would say, somewhat past it. Someone like Danny Garcia, who, you know, is a name and still pretty decent, you know, but he's not
47.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, he had success at 147, but he's mainly a light welterweight. And you said about Sean Porter, those fights between Spence and Crawford were seen as big, huge fights at the time. But for me, Porter, good analyst, good fighter, always gives it his all, no matter who he's fighting. I never saw him as one of the elite level fighters. What's interesting as well, talk about the ebb and flow, is the sort of how they're both playing to each other. Spence, as you say, he's ostensibly, even given the amateur career, and I first became aware of Spence at the Olympics when I was scouting out, you know, the American Olympic team, back when you still cared about the American Olympic team. Cyril Spence, and you go, oh yeah, this guy, he looks like something. And actually, Olympics and up to sort of Cal Brook fight seems quite sort of pedestrian, really, for me. I wasn't as blown away by him as I thought I was going to be. But I think that's sort of quite interesting because plays into him stylistically. He does build as a fight goes. Yeah, he does start off. He gets on the jab early, front foot pressure. He's constantly doubling, tripling the jab, putting you in positions, but actually does build to a crescendo. And that's when he really comes into his own. Stylistically, that plays into Crawford. He's going to give him a lot of data to work with. Crawford's going to spit that back out, and that's when he's going to have his big moment. So they sort of play off each other, and I think that's why it's an interesting dynamic. What's great as well is Spence really good using lead hand work, tie guys up on the inside, lots of hand fighting, crafty in that regard. He's a real quality pressure fighter. I think, as I say, with the amateur background, I think people expect and kind of go in with this preconceived notion that he's sort of boxer or a boxer puncher type, because that's what we expect for American welterweights. He's not, really. He's an out-and-out pressure fighter. And he's very good at it. And the one really interesting dynamic in this fight is that Crawford's also really good at fighting hands, incorporates grappling into his training. You know, we've seen him jokingly wrestle and stuff like that. He's a guy who's not going to be overwhelmed by the physicality of Errol Spence. So I just think they play off each other in a really interesting way. And the ebb and flow that you describe is what I envision too. I think it's got potential to be a bit of a modern classic. And what's interesting too is neither of them really fought much in the way of Southpaws. Cal Brook was a switch hitter. He, you know, primarily fought orthodox against in both bouts. You know, we've talked about common opponents. I mentioned Chris Van Heerden, not what we'd consider a savvy Southpaw, quality fighter though he was in his day. And Terence Crawford has fought a handful of what we would describe as top quality Southpaws. I would say Felix Diaz and the terrible African. Yeah, there you go. So, you know, who I did like, awkward, gangly, but you're not going to put him on the top level of Southpaw. So really, like you say, for both guys, this is the top fighter either are going to fight in their careers, more than likely. It's the best fighter either have fought today, and it's the best Southpaw they fought today. Crawford does favour Southpaw stance against fellow Southpaws, which is why I brought it up. So we are likely to see a closed stance matchup. But, you know, orthodox fighters have had no issues landing jabs on Spence from that stance either. No issues sort of landing to his body. Porter had no issues at all. He did square up and actually fight Southpaw on inside clinches with Spence, sort of throwing hell for leather. Your Denny Zugas, obviously not a stylistic comparison for Crawford, but certainly as a tall, lanky punch picker, you can make some sort of comparisons there. He had no issues getting around the back elbow of Spence and land to the body. He had no issues jabbing with him. So there is a path for Crawford from either stance, but I do think, based on tape study, that he will favour Southpaw, and I do think we'll see a close stance matchup. So next thing for me to think to mention to you is, you know, how's it feeling from an insider's perspective, running boxing news, and of course all the online media that you guys do? Are you hearing anything behind the scenes? Are you hearing from people you ask? Obviously, you said people seem to be leaning Crawford. Is there anyone that's made any bold proclamations? Don't even mention any names, but is there anything interesting as we edge closer to fight week that you've heard that might be, that might come into play?
Well, sorry to be very boring, but no, not really.
That's
fine. I'm off to Vegas on Monday morning, so I will hopefully have a little bit more of an inside track when I get over there. But look, I don't think there really is. I think if somebody told me that, the only thing that would surprise me, or what I would consider a bold pick, is if someone expected somebody to go and clean someone out early. I can't see that happening. There's too much on the line. The stakes are too high, and I think they both respect each other. And the kind of just the way that they naturally box, I can't see it happening. So even people who have picked Crawford to win by stoppage, I don't think that's a wild pick. I, like you, think the fight will go the distance, but I can see routes to Crawford, as we mentioned earlier, kind of assessing the landscape, getting that data, and then in the second half of the fight, finding the shot or finding the combination that ultimately gets the job done. I'd be probably surprised if Spence was able to deliver any sort of stoppage, more so than Crawford. I can see a route to Spence winning a decision, kind of getting off to a quicker start than Crawford. Maybe they, you know, Crawford has the best of the middle rounds, and then Spence either motors in those last few rounds, or it is close and he gets a close contentious decision. I'm going back to one of your first points, I completely agree. I think Sunday will be a bloodbath on Twitter. I think anything that's even remotely competitive or close will have a controversial, so to speak, outcome, and it will be received as such. But no, I think, as I say, it is a 50-50 fight. I think that I could sit here and make an argument, or I kind of have, for both guys. And I think that's what's made this such a fascinating fight. And I do see there being so many wrinkles to the fight and so many changes in momentum and tactics and, you know, adjusting to adjustments. I think that anything really, apart from those early round stoppages, is in play here. Like, you could see Spence grind him down. If we see a career best performance from Spence, and, you know, he rehydrates well and he goes in and he's big and he's able to physically manhandle Crawford, which, again, I agree with you. I can't necessarily see that. Crawford is very physically strong. He's kind of got that very strong core strength and that natural athleticism where I think he'll be able to hold his own on the inside. I don't think that'll be his game plan to bang it out with Spence, but, you know, I think he's more than capable of holding his own in there. But you could see Spence kind of, well, in a kind of fictitious scenario, being busy and attritional and potentially grinding him down late in the fight. So I think pretty much every outcome is in play. It's going to be interesting to see how Spence is at the weight. I think we are still in the kind of danger zone, I guess, of him making the weight. Has he stayed at the weight just to make this fight? Because it is a career-defining fight for both men. I don't think he's going to really know that until probably Wednesday of fight week. That's when the real weight cut will start. I'd imagine he'll be nil by mouth and flushing out fluids from the Wednesday onwards, or certainly not, if not the Wednesday, then certainly Thursday from the press conference onwards. And then we don't know. I think Bud has now grown into being a fully fledged welterweight, which I think at the start of his reign at welterweight and the start of, like, from Jeff Horn onwards, I think the Jeff Horn fight, he still looked a little underdeveloped, but I still think he looked a little bit like a guy who would come up through the weights. Whereas I think now he does look, he has that menace and that presence of somebody who's settled into the weight. So I think that's one of the things that I'm most looking forward to. And I think with any big fight, it's always an interesting thing to see when you've got one guy, especially in Spence, who is tight at the weight and is big for the weight, how he's going to respond to the weight cut. So that's the one thing that I will be going out and definitely trying to find out and see if there's any inside track. Because I do think that if Spence is going to win the fight, he needs to have a strong finish.
Yeah, because he's got a 12-round engine, 100%.
Yeah, he's going to have to. Because those middle rounds, Crawford's going to have success because he's too good a fighter not to. And like you've said, the kind of flip side, I guess, to Spence being busy and throwing 70, 80 punches around is that you do leave yourself open. You do leave yourself open to counters coming back. And, you know, you mentioned Crawford deciphering the data and spitting it back at him. So that's why I could see also a scenario where Spence is somewhat negative and cagey. You know, obviously completely different fighters, but he was like that really with Mikey Garcia, where he was kind of almost sort of went out of his way to make it a dull affair, really, in some instances.
Against a guy who wasn't really offering much back.
No, exactly. So, but one of Crawford's kind of, I guess, kryptonite for me, and we saw it to a degree in the Sean Porter fight, is somebody who can win rounds. We've got Canelo, Javonte Davis is another one, and Crawford, who have this kind of apex predator on the front foot, stalking, looking for the big counters. But if you don't give it to them, then they naturally will lose rounds. We saw it with Canelo against Caleb Plant, seen it with Javonte Davis against Mario Barrios, and, well, lots of other fighters where he gives away rounds in a way that Terence Crawford doesn't. But it is still a case of, if he doesn't get you, then naturally he's going to be giving up rounds on the cards. So I think Spence will be mindful of that, and Derek James will be mindful of that, and getting those rounds banked early on and leaving enough for a big push at the end. I think Spence will be thinking, if I can win three of the first four rounds and three of the last four rounds, then I only need one of the last four and I've got it. And I think if it is close, look, he is the A side in this fight, and that may not sit well with people, but it is true. We know that this is a business. There is a two-way rematch clause. We all love a bit of controversy. If it's close, you know, a kind of, I guess, history and everything that we know about sport will tell us that Spence is likely to get it as the A side of the promotion, the PBC star, the house fighter. So I think, yeah, I've kind of rambled around various different potentials.
That's cool, you're there, mate. You've got to do it.
But do it. Yeah, in a long story short, I haven't heard much, but nothing that I could hear, I think, at this point, unless somebody told me, look, Spence has been really, you know, he's been really struggling at the weight and he got buzzed in the gym and it came from like a good source, then I would probably pay attention to it. But outside of that, I think over the years, we've all gone through all of these various scenarios and what ifs and how and da da da, that we all kind of have exhausted every potential outcome. And other than an early stoppage, as I said, I wouldn't really be surprised with anything.
You raise an interesting point now. Didn't really consider that. Tight the weight, needing a strong finish, Spence might not come out as he usually does. He might actually be a bit negative. And in that case, it's a battle with the jabs. They've both got good jabs. Crawford, I'd say, more accurate. I'd say Spence more busy. That will be interesting. That'll be interesting. Not what really expecting. I am expecting Spence to come out because I think that's just who he is. The Garcia fight, good comparison, really good example. That was a weird one. I have always wondered if there was... And I'm not one of these idiots who cries fix everything, you know that. But I have always wondered if there was a kind of, you know, we're doing this for the money sort of agreement, you know, he's much smaller than you kind of thing. Or if Spence, just knowing how much smaller he was, just went, I'll just sort of go for the motions here. I don't need to get too busy. It did seem sort of out of character, that performance. We talk about the Cal Brook fight as well. I mean, Cal Brook, I think people forget, he had success early against Errol Spence. And if he had not had his physicality ripped away from him in that, what I consider a folly against Golovkin, I think most people do. I think we did at the time, but even now it looks particularly disastrous matchmaking and dangerous matchmaking. I wonder if he would have been able to sustain it. I don't think Cal Brook has ever been a fighter who deals with adversity too well. But certainly, I don't think his face would have got broken in that way. We might have seen a different fight. But the fact he had so much success early, just punch picking and jabbing with Spence, makes me think that if Spence doesn't get a foothold early, I think Bud might just pick him apart. So if we're expecting Bud to have good middle rounds and then the late rounds to be really competitive, I think Spence does need to guarantee he takes those early rounds. And I'm not sure he will do, boxing his way in. I think, you know, well, he'll box his way in as he always does. But I think if he doesn't punctuate that with big moments. And that's the thing what you spoke about, Bud Crawford, that's really interesting about round stealing and whatnot. He has big moments. Spence might outland him in a round, but those uppercuts coming from, or the hooks round the guard, they really do snap your head back. And that's how Bud Crawford can nick rounds when he's maybe not being as busy. But it's just a really interesting fight. I just think it's the big one this week. I think we're all excited from a boxing perspective. From an all-round combat sports perspective, it's really exciting because there's loads going on in MMA as well. It's a really big week. I know Errol Spence said no one's going to be paying attention to Bellator, but there are some weirdos that will be because it's a big card out in Japan and it's loads of weird freak show fights. And, you know, the home of combat sports is Japan, in my opinion, and there's just loads happening there this week. So for the weirdos, there's plenty going on, but I do think that Crawford Spence is the main attraction, and it's that sort of shit that brings us together. So, final thoughts. Let's make a final prediction. We've gone around the houses. We've done all sorts. I'm going to go, and I'll tell you what. I think you've convinced me somewhat based on the promotional angle. Just a quick one though about that. Bud Crawford, he's signed with PBC now, or is he essentially free agent mercenary, or has he got a deal with PBC?
He's got a two-fight deal, but I think the second fight of the deal it will be the rematch. It's a two-way rematch clause, so whoever, if the loser decides to enforce it, then the other guy has to come along. So he has a two-fight deal with PBC. So he's not a lone wolf, but I mean, it's very similar.
Oh, kind of convinces me now though that he might win this one, and they might keep the bouncing house on the rematch. But you make a really good point. They're going to want to guarantee a rematch because it's good business. I think if it's tight and close, I could see Spence winning the decision. If we take that sort of, you know, what goes part and parcel of boxing out of it, which we shouldn't, because, you know, we have to second guess ourselves. We have to look at the judges that are lined up. If we see Adelaide Bird, we know there's going to be 2-1-1-5-1-1-3s and then a 120-108. We have to take that into consideration. But if we don't, if we just go on an ebb and flow boxing basis, I'll go Terence Crawford by 12th round stoppage, 11th round stoppage. Let's go. Let's be fucking bold. Let's take the judges out of the equation entirely and say that Crawford puts it together late. I mean, because let's be honest, it's not like your Denny Ugas didn't hurt Spence. The commentary team didn't seem to notice the original right hand that looked somewhat innocuous that took his legs from him. It wasn't just the fact that he got caught on the break. He was fucking hurt in that fight. And I can see all that. Look, what you've mentioned, you've convinced me both ways. If it goes the distance, Spence might get it. But the weight cut, the car crash, the eye injury, the tough fights he had, that last fight he had, which was tough. He hasn't fought for over a year or coming up to it. Yeah, go on. Fuck it. Let's go bold. I'll go Terence Crawford to get him out of there late. I think that he's going to be able to sense a pattern. He's going to see patterns, get his big shots off, and he's going to, as Spence tries to get back into it late, he will overextend. He will give Crawford too many opportunities. He can hit it with something coming from underneath, uppercut, take him out. He's no David Avanesian, but I quite like David Avanesian, so I was really impressed by that performance. I think Aficionados liked him, and I think that really showed Crawford's strengths and setups. Let's go bold. Crawford, 11th round, TKO.
Okay, well, I hope you're right. I hope there is a late drama in the fight, one way or the other. I think it'd be great if it's, and I do see there being a lot of changes of momentum in the fight. I do expect Spence to have the early rounds. I expect Bud to come into it in those middle rounds, potentially hurt Spence. And then I think it'll all be down to, I don't like to say it because it's nonsense, but who really wants it in those last few rounds? Generally speaking, I hate to say stuff like that because, of course, they both want it. But you've got two guys who are at the very, very top of their game. And I think it will be close right up until the end of the fight, whether the fight's... I can't really see a one-sided whooping and then a stoppage. I think they're two good fighters and they're too good for it to be a one-sided affair. And also their natural kind of styles and the way that they approach fights. Crawford is not... He doesn't, you know, very rarely will come out and rubber stamp things from round one and just blow someone away. He will kind of have his moments where he's allowing fighters to come onto him just so he can pick his shots. I've got to stay with it because I've been saying it for certainly sort of loud and proud for 3 years. And then the last couple of years, probably a little bit less loud and a little bit less proud about Spence. But I'm going to go for Spence by close, competitive, potentially controversial decision. I think that he will pick up some of those early rounds. And I think the last few rounds will be close. And there may be a case of him being hurt late on and having to see it out. And then still potentially on some people's cards losing the fight, but getting a very close, competitive and potentially controversial decision. I'm not going to upset our mate Chris Williamson and say it's going to be a split decision, but I think it's going to be close. And I think... I don't know whether, like, I don't have a horse in the race. It doesn't bother me who wins or not. But I think over the years, having kind of one pick, but now you've just mentioned there, running through the inactivity, the accidents, the eye injury, all of that, all of the signs are there for a Crawford win, I think. But these fights have a wonderful way sometimes of just bringing something out of the truly elite fighters. And these are two of the best fighters in the world, and certainly the best two welterweights in the world. I know Jaron Ennis might have something to say about that, but at the minute he can't gate crash the top two. So I'm going to go for Spence, but and I don't like to caveat picks and I don't like to sit on the fence. I would not be surprised at all. And I don't think anyone can be surprised. If Spence was to win, I think people picking Crawford, I think, it shouldn't be a huge surprise. No matter how good he is and no matter everything that's happened, it is still an elite, unbeaten, big, strong, busy welterweight. So I'm going to go for Errol Spence by very, very, very close decision. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's like, particularly the last couple of months, I've not really had as much focus on boxing, the traditional sort of boxing angle as I have in the past. And this is one that's kind of woke me up from my, I guess, administrative coma that I've been in for the last 3 months, going through various P&Ls and projections and spreadsheets and stuff. And I have now kind of awoken from that, and I'm really looking forward to it next week. I think, like you, it's going to be a great fight. I think it will be one of the fights of the years, and I don't really see how it lets us down. I mean, I may live to regret that, but I think the style, everything that's on the line and where they are in their careers now. You've got Crawford, who's kind of, this is his moment now. He's a 3-8 world champion. He's very accomplished on paper, but this is his win. This is his legacy win. And for Spence, this is his opportunity to show that despite all of that adversity that he's had in his career, that he's able to, you know, throw in people's faces. I think the narrative that is kind of accepted, I suppose, is that maybe over the years Crawford wanted this fight more than Spence. I mean, I don't subscribe to that because I don't know the ins and outs, but I'm sure that Spence would like to kind of stick that up people if he's able to get the win and show people that he's the number one welterweight in the world. And that might just bring something out of him that we haven't seen yet. But I'm very, very excited by it, as I'm sure you are. And I think we're going to get a great fight.
We're not going to be staying up, mate. You talk about getting your zest back. I know you didn't get into boxing coverage because you like spreadsheets and pie charts. You got into it because you like boxing, and it's just so happened that it's turned out for you that you're now into spreadsheets and pie charts. But for me, you know, we joked before recording started, but, you know, I'm in my mid to late 30s now. You know, I haven't got I hate to use the same word, but I haven't got the zest I used to have. I'm not battling out on the forums anymore. This is the kind of fight that's going to get me to stay up. You mentioned our mate Chris Williams, and also you know him from you know boxing coverage. I know him from the forums back in the day. I think what he particularly hates when people say they scored a fight, a split decision. I absolutely can see a split decision in this fight. It's a fine prediction, mate. As we say, it's going to be what I reckon. You're going to have two cards, a 1-1-5, maybe a 1-1-4, and then you're going to have something egregious. It always happens in big fights. But for those that are listening to this podcast that follow me, maybe for MMA coverage, kickboxing coverage, Muay Thai, maybe they're getting swept up in the big fight fever, just as we are, but they're not necessarily boxing fans. They're not going to be aware of your work. They're not going to be aware of the prestigious history of boxing news, which historians like myself, we're still reading old issues of, as it was called then, boxing, to get the skinny on the fights from over 100 years ago. Where can people find you? Where can people find your content for the ID Boxing Conglomerate?
Yeah, so we're obviously Boxing News available online. Boxing News Online, you can get your subscription there, or you know some retailers will have them. And depending on where you live and where you can pick it up, you can walk down to your local WH Smith and pick up Boxing News Mag. We've got the mag coming next week with an exclusive interview with Errol Spence. We also have followers across social media. I think a big part of the kind of the new era of boxing news is, of course, a bit more digital and social content, which is kind of my background. But just on the old archive, we are working on a few bits on the archive at the minute that should excite historians like yourself, looking to digitize the whole back archive that we have. But with 114 years of archive, it's not a job that can be done overnight. But yeah, look out for it. You know, we're taking a full team over there. We've got editorial, we'll have video, we'll have pretty much everything that you could want. So we're looking to roll out the big guns and give this fight the coverage that it deserves, because we're all excited by it. And hopefully we get what we're expecting, which is a great fight. And you can catch all of the latest and greatest coverage of Spence Crawford on Boxing News.
Once in a generation,
the time has come.
A fight makes history.
It's champion versus champion.
Before anyone steps in the ring, Errol Spence Jr., Terrence Crawford, the most anticipated fight of the decade is here. Undefeated, undisputed, unprecedented. Spence versus Crawford for the Undisputed World title, Saturday, July 29th, live on pay-per-view.
Thanks to Rob Tebbutt there. And you know what else is going on pay-per-view? My breakdown of the Spence Crawford fight, only on the Combat Chronicles Patreon. That address again, www.patreon.com/Combat Chronicles. You get the breakdown, you get the preview on this feed, you get the post-fight analysis on that feed. I gave it in a way, Fulton. Come on now. What else are you going to get on the Patreon this week? Well, obviously we've got a UFC card, we've got the aforementioned Bellator versus Rising card. I just don't know if I'm going to be able to fit that in this week. Bellator Rising, watching it, I mean, because it's going to stray into Sunday morning. And as I say, I'm an old bastard, a fat fucker as well, and I get tired easy. So I'm probably going to catch up with UFC at some point Sunday, try and Patreon pod about that too, at least, you know, what tickles my fancy. Definitely the main fights on the card, Poirier Gaethje rematch, and Alex Pereira versus Jan Blachowicz. Probably some more as well. But obviously, the main attraction, as I said throughout this episode, this week is a boxing week. So if you want to hear my thoughts on Spence Crawford and whatever else I fancy talking about, head on over to the Patreon. That's that website again, www.patreon.com/Combat Chronicles. A couple of bucks a month, you get access to the whole back catalogue, audio documentary such as the recently released How to Catch a Spider, which is a 1 hour long audio documentary all about Chris Weidman versus Anderson Silva 1, the upcoming Guide to Pride 1, other audio documentaries, other bonus podcasts, breakdown fights, preview fights, all sorts of stuff on there. Whatever I fancy chucking out, basically. Scans of magazines, scans of on-site programs from MMA bouts 2 decades ago. It's just all sorts of weird and wonderful shit on there. So if you like what you heard in this episode, be sure to check that out. If you liked listening to me, be sure to give this a 5-star rating and a review, because that actually does help the main free podcast feed be more visible to others. If you like me, hit me up on Twitter at @combatcr. If you like me even more, you can find me on Instagram at @combatchroniclespod, and that's the same account that I've got over on Threads, which is pretty much dead, isn't it? And I'll tell you what, I told you to follow me on Twitter. It's X now. We'll see how much longer for, eh? But I'll tell you what's not going to go on for much longer, and that's this episode. So, as I say, hit me up on the socials. hit me up on Patreon. Brace yourself for more exclusive content. If you're a cheapo, wait for a couple of weeks and I'll be back on this feed. Until next time, thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. Really appreciate it. Peace out.